Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We begin the hour with Denny Kamik. He's South Dakota's Secretary of the Department of Corrections. As the South Dakota legislature embarks on another session, we're taking time to talk legislative priorities. Kamik was appointed his position by Governor Dennis Dugard in 2011. The Department of Corrections manages the state's adult and juvenile correctional facilities, adult parole services, and juvenile aftercare. Denny Kamik, welcome to In the Moment.
Well, good morning, Lori.
We appreciate you taking the time. You're joining us via phone from Pierre. Let's start right away with some of those legislative priorities. Does the DOC have any bills on the table out of the gate here?
You know, individually as a department, we really have one bill. That's Senate Bill 16, and it was in the Senate Judiciary this morning and came out unanimously from them. What it does is actually clarify the penalty for escaped inmates that are in a facility or are not in the confines of a prison. We have people that are in treatment halfway houses. There are health issues with individuals, where they're be in nursing homes or hospice care. And then we have some that are in extended confinement in the community as well. So, although the law changed a number of years ago to define someone that walks away from a minimum unit as, of course, less than from a secure facility, we would just clarifying the language or attempting to clarify the language of that. And that started this morning, and it came out of Senate Judicial this morning.
Any particular reason to look at that now this year?
Well, I think one of the things that we are doing is we are using extended confinement more than what we have in the past. And we look at somebody that is a minimum status offender, low risk, low need, within 4 months of their release date. They have no violent offenses. They're compliant with their IPD, their individual program directive. And they have an approved release plan, and when we're doing that, we're putting a GPS on them, and then they're being supervised by parole.
And that's sort of what you're looking for as an agency bill, but you're involved with others. Let's go there and talk about what else is on your table.
Well, it's been a busy year different task forces and work groups that have been out there. I was privileged to be on Chief Gilbertson's mental health task force this year that was supported by Governor Dugard. I think the Chief Justice outlined that well yesterday in his legislative address. But the priorities of that are, you know, number one, to improve public safety. Number two, to effectively identify those individuals that have mental illness at the beginning when they come into the criminal justice system. And then three, to better allocate resources to improve that early interventions. You know, we find that individuals that are arrested and placed in the county jail, those that have mental illness issues stay longer in jail than those that do not. And the main concern to start the task force was to speed up the competency exams that are needed for court and the like, and then identify resources in the community to treat those individuals. And the main thought of that is try to divert individuals that are in jail for criminal offenses basically starting on the street with the use of crisis intervention teams. If they are arrested, try to divert people to the mental health treatment. For those in jail, to try to expand the professionals that can conduct the competency exams. It was just taking way too long for that to get in the hands of the attorneys and the judges. And then we set a 21-day turnaround for those competency exams to get done, and then increase the individuals that can perform those competency exams. In South Dakota law, psychiatrists and psychologists can, but what we are attempting to do with legislation this year is to add add certified social workers, advanced practical nurse, and a licensed professional counselor in mental health. And so that's kind of what the task force looked at, and a lot of that is prior to DOC. I understand that, but I think we have some strong interest in that. We do know that jails and prisons can exacerbate individuals that have mental illness. And if we can, at the front end, divert and find programming and treatment for those individuals in the community, we believe fewer of those individuals will actually come to prison. And so that helps us a lot. You know, inside of our prison, our Department of Social Services provides our mental health services, and they do a wonderful job with that. And, you know, our staff are trained. We're all trained in mental health first aid, the staff of the DOC is. And then by the end of this March, all of our facility staff will be trained in DBT, which is dialectical behavior therapy, cognitive treatment. So I think we're on a good path.
And so what about the moment when someone is released back into the community and they've received treatment inside the walls of a correctional facility, a state facility? What sort of transitional programs do you have to help people get the help they need on the outside?
Well, we make sure if they're on supervision with parole, we make sure that they have their treatment providers on the street, and they have to, if a treatment provider has laid out a plan for them, A, B, C, and D, that they need to be compliant with that for them to be successful. If they're not compliant with that, they're violating their supervision agreement.
Did you discuss in the mental health task force about, you know, things like the cost of medication for folks that maybe wouldn't end up serving time if they had stayed on the medication that they need?
Well, we didn't spend a lot of time on that. I know there was some issues of that and some talk of that. I think there are programs out there where they are provided when an offender leaves our facility that has that is on medication for mental health. They are given a supply when they leave, and they are given a prescription along with an appointment is already set up with their mental health provider. So that is a seamless transition. Now, not to say that they're going to be compliant on that, but it is certainly set up and encouraged. And if they're on supervision, of course, it is part of their supervision agreement.
In the State of the Judiciary address, Chief Justice David Gilbertson, when he was talking about the mental health task force, had some pretty stark numbers about how many people relating to domestic assault had mental health issues, or I'm sorry, that was meth issues and drug issues that he was talking about there, and then certain with you know, mental health issues as well. In your experience, have you noticed that the huge population inside state facilities that are there for drug offenses or mental health issues? Is that consistent with your experience?
It certainly is. It goes back to my work as a police officer and on the Board of Pardons and Paroles, and in this job, is that a lot of people have co-occurring disorders, and the individual may be addicted to meth and a number of drugs will certainly cause individuals to have mental problems. And there are people that are on the street and that have mental health issues, and they self-medicate, and they do not use the medication they should when they self-medicate. They use something like meth or other drugs to self-medicate. And so when they come into a jail or they come into the prison, there's that period of trying to separate those two and figure out what is the source and what came first, so to speak. But we try to deal with those and work with those co-occurring conditions.
If you could wave your magic wand, what would you sort of have happening in the state of South Dakota to reduce the number of people who are coming in with those sort of problems?
Well, the first issue, I think, is the one that, you know, is very clear in the state of South Dakota. The methamphetamine epidemic that we have in the state of South Dakota is causing many issues for many individuals and families. And my heart goes out to those families and those individuals that have a methamphetamine addiction. It is very addictive. I think Governor Dugard expressed that very clearly in his State of the State address on Tuesday, and we are just need to try to battle that methamphetamine epidemic that we have in South Dakota.
Let's talk about a new warden for the women's prison. What do you have to share about this new person coming in?
Well, Brent Fluke started with us, I'm trying to go from memory here, 2006-2007 at Mike Durfee. He worked there in a number of capacities. He also was the manager at the Rapid City Community Works Center for a couple of years. He then received a promotion to associate warden at Mike Durfee and moved back to Yankton Springfield area, and now he is the warden of the women's prison. He is very capable, and I have he'll do just a wonderful job.
We talked with Democrat Susan Wismer before she headed over to Pierre, and I think she reiterated some of her concerns that she's seeing in her hometown about juvenile justice reform and lack of consequences for things from truancy to other crimes. Do you expect to see adjustments to the juvenile justice reform this legislative session?
You know, the Juvenile Justice Oversight Council met in Pierre on December 12th. And they were working through some adjustments of the bill that was passed in 2015. You know, when you do these comprehensive major shifts in how we handle, whether it was the Adult South Dakota Public Safety Improvement Act or the juvenile justice, you're going to have tweaks and things that you need to do. And I think those are being addressed. There's some recommendations that have come out of the Oversight Council that will be dealt with in the legislature this year. I think part of the frustration that individuals have is, okay, if they're not going to go to the DOC, where are they going to go and how are they going to get dealt with? And, you know, we have three wonderful programs in South Dakota that we can use for these low-need, low-risk individuals that before came to our facility. And functional family therapy, I think, is the top of the list, and it's available throughout South Dakota. And there's a few places in the rural areas where they're having some difficulty, but the most of the population has that. And, you know, I think part of the frustration with that is that school systems and parents and so didn't think that they could access that. Didn't know that they could refer many individuals, and that is a wonderful program where it actually goes in, and if Johnny is raising his head in the school system or with law enforcement or whatever, it's not only looking at Johnny there that is having an issue, but then going back into the family and seeing if there's some needs of the family, whether it is drug addiction, whether it is mental health, or what the issue may be, and go in and try to work that. And by doing so, you will fix the family, you fix Johnny, and of course, Johnny's siblings who may follow that path. So I think that's very good. We have moral recognition therapy. We have ART, aggression replacement therapy. So we have a number of fixes and a number of programs and treatment that we have out there. You know, it's been the a major influx of funds in order to deal with treatment. I think it was $6.1 million that was put in the budget. So that is there. One of the issues that they had frustration with, the school system did, is the truancy citations. We set up for a few of the issues that juveniles get into trouble with, that they just would get a citation and then you have to pay the money on that citation, you know, like you would a speeding ticket or something like to that effect. And the truancy issue came up to where some jurisdictions were experiencing a high level of noncompliance in that and trouble with the truancy. And when that is the case, if a youth is noncompliant in paying the citation, the cost of that ticket, then there will be legislation that is offered this year that will allow the courts to then formally petition those individuals that are noncompliant, and I think that will be a major fix and release some frustration there.
Secretary Danny Kamig leads the South Dakota Department of Corrections. Sir, we appreciate your time. Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you.
See you next time. When we come back, a lesson in punctuation from the South Dakota Supreme Court, plus SDPB's newest contributor, Kevin Wooster, is with us. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio. The importance of punctuation and grammar was at issue in the South Dakota Supreme Court yesterday. In a case involving open records, justices heard from lawyers representing the Argus Leader and the city of Sioux Falls. The dispute revolves around the wording of one short paragraph in the open records chapter and whether it allows government entities to keep records closed when they've entered into a contract. SDPB's Victoria Wicks reports.
Prior to 2009, South Dakota law established that government records were closed unless there was some reason to open them. In 2009, the South Dakota legislature flipped that concept and passed statutes to support the presumption that government documents are open unless there's a reason they should be kept closed. Some of those reasons are outlined in the Open Records chapter. Now jump forward to October 2015, when the Argus Leader asked for a copy of the settlement agreement between the City of Sioux Falls and other parties involving subpar siding on the Sanford Premier Center. The contractual parties agreed to keep the particulars confidential, except that the amount of settlement was $1 million. The city turned down the Argus Leader's request, relying on Exemption 20 in the open records laws. That exemption allows governments to keep confidential, quote, any document declared closed or confidential by court order, comma, contract, comma, or stipulation of the parties to any civil or criminal action or proceeding. Much discussion revolved around that second comma. Does it set the word contract apart? The city says it does. The Argus Leader, represented by John Arneson, holds that the city's interpretation of the statute defeats the objective of the open records chapter.
This simply says documents that anybody can, by means of contract, keep confidential. It doesn't describe what documents. It doesn't have any limitation on the type of documents. It simply says if you want to keep a document undescribed, unspecified, a secret, just make a contract and say it's a secret, and you're okay.
Arneson says that reading of the statute comes from faulty punctuation. James Moore represents the city of Sioux Falls. He says that comma leads to a correct interpretation. He says the language of the statute is clear, and it intends to allow exemptions when a contract is in place. He says in this case, the city did not act unilaterally. It entered into a contract with other parties, and they all agreed to keep details confidential.
A contract is a judicially enforceable document. It requires offer and acceptance. It requires consideration. It requires mutuality. It's judicially enforceable, and that's why it fits. That's why it fits in that series, court order, contract, stipulation of the parties to a proceeding.
Moore says if the exemption leads to abuses, the political system will correct it, and the legislature will change the statute if need be. Justices will rule on the issue at a later date. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
South Dakota Public Broadcasting is pleased to welcome our newest contributor. You most likely already know Kevin Wooster. He's been a political junkie, a political journalist, and a blogger, among other jobs in journalism and the press and letters in general. You can find his SDPB blog online now. Go to sdpb.org/Wooster. I'll spell it for you, WOSTER, sdpb.org/Wooster. Kevin Wooster, welcome to In the Moment.
It's so good to be here, Lori.
It is so good to have you here. I was trying to keep it a secret from everybody until we knew for sure you were coming on board, and it was a pretty hard secret to keep.
Yeah, I was trying to keep it a secret, too. And as my wife and most of my family will tell you, I've got such a big mouth that usually that doesn't work out very well. But I did my best.
Well, let's put the big mouth to use, right?
Okay.
So I'm looking at the blog, and first of all, you know, it's just beautifully written, smartly written, so well constructed. And you're a writer. You've been with Kello TV. You've worked in television broadcasting. What do you consider yourself primarily?
Confused most of the time, but today I have sort of a laser focus on this new venture, which is very exciting to me. And I started out in the business as a photographer, a news photographer, and my brother Terry always says I'm more of a photographer in the way I cover stories. Well, he's more of a biographer. And I try to make my writing visual. I try to make my expressions meaningful. I have done some poetry writing, so I try to include a little bit of that in what I write, and that included news stories and columns, and in the last 12 years or so, blogs. So I hope to bring a lot of that to this blog and hope to engage people in ways that they find entertaining and maybe even enlightening sometimes.
I want to talk about the history of your blogging and the potential of this blog, but before we do that, I want to start out with where you started your column, which is with your family. Why start out your first column or blog with the notion of, I am not my brothers?
Well, there's been a little bit of confusion over the years. In fact, for a while, my brother Terry has been a reporter in South Dakota forever with 40 legislative sessions covered, which I think is just amazing, first of all, that he did it, secondly, that he came out of it sane. And I've done 15 or 16, I think, and I've been more of a natural research reporter / political reporter, ag reporter over the time, and I've kind of gone back and forth to different organizations, the Journal, the Argus. I've been in Peer to cover the Capitol, and Terry and I actually did that at the same time for the Argus, and at the same time when he was at the Argus and I was with the Journal. So at one point, some people would say, are you the West River or the East River Wooster? We looked more alike then. I actually took to wearing a belt buckle that said Kevin on it around the Capitol so that it would help people ID us a little bit. And as I get older, I start to look a little bit more like my older brother, Jim. And that adds to the confusion. Yeah, you know, he was a Stockyards guy, and he gave the markets on Kello for years. He had his own show on Kello for years. He's on the radio still all the time. So there's a great deal of confusion sometimes about which is which, and so that's why I started out with From the Other Wooster Brother.
So what's been the impact on you for having a famous name in South Dakota?
It's been helpful and sometimes a little bit irritating. I when I'm someplace and I feel like I've established myself as a journalist, because I've worked out of Brookings, I've worked out of Sioux Falls, I've worked out of Pierre, and I've worked out of Rapid. And there are times when people will say to me, oh, I just love your writing. You're such a beautiful writer. And especially when you told that story about your daughter, Jennifer, when she did the ballet, I'd say, yeah, that's my brother. And then it would be, and I will get sometimes, you know, are you the guy that was on the Stockyards News? No, that's not me. That's the Rhinestone Cowboy, Jim. So it's been a benefit more than anything else, and it's been a great family. It is a great family to be a part of, even though both my sisters, as I point out, there have kind of tried to keep a lower profile and distance themselves from us a little bit. So
how did the blogging thing come about? Because you were blogging before it was cool.
Yes, not by my own choice. I didn't have a clue what a weblog was when Bill Harlan came up to me in the Rapid City Journal newsroom during that hot U.S. Senate campaign in 2004 between Daschle and Thune, and said, hey, I'm starting a weblog. And I said, well, maybe you should consider seeing a doctor about that, or maybe a therapist or something. And I said, what in the world is a weblog? And he said at the time, it's the future, Wooster. And I didn't believe him. And he named his blog Mount Blogmore, which he told me I could call it a blog, not a weblog. And I was slow to embrace that. I didn't think blogs had a future. It was just one more headache for a busy reporter. But Harlan and Denise Ross, a very bright, very capable and aggressive reporter, they were engaged by it and committed to it, and they convinced me to join in, and that was 2004. And I was with Mount Blogmore for 9 years. By then, Denise and Bill had left the paper and kind of left it with me and a few other reporters, but I was the main moderator. And then when I left the Journal in 2013, I started my own blog briefly, and then Kello. I had three blogs on Kello, which I managed not as well as I would have liked to, considering three blogs, around my TV work.
When did you first... Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Well, and that's when I retired from Kello last October. I thought, I'll start my own blog, because I got to have a blog in my life. And then we started to talking to this guy named Larry Rohr with a much better radio voice than I have, and eventually came to this blog thing, which is very exciting for me.
What is it about blogging that you really can't walk away from?
Oh, you know, there's an immediacy to it. There's the notion that it can be just a thought that you have driving downtown and you see a bumper sticker that sparks something in you and go back and write three paragraphs. Or you can do something like I did this morning where you try to encapsulate 40 or 50 years of your life. Or you can get into a deep philosophical discussion or a deep political discussion. I mean, even today, the first post that I have, I see there's a comment from a woman named Jeannie who raises the On Being show and Eugene Peterson. And that got us started on, who's a theologian, and that got us started on Bono, Eugene Peterson, and the Psalms, which I put a video up, and now we're having an exchange there. So it's that kind of community and that kind of enlargement of an issue and enlargement of your thinking that can be the really upside of the blog. And, of course, there is a downside if they're not properly managed.
Sure. So how do you get from the blog, I should say, if you're just joining us, Kevin Wooster, new blog on sdpb.org/Wooster. It's called On the Other Hand. And I want to talk to you about the overall philosophy of that blog. But first, I have to know how you got to Eugene Peterson and Krista Tippett and the Psalms from your very first blog post. What was the piece, what was the sentence that sort of pulled that out and kicked it in that direction?
Well, I thank Jeannie, and that's all I know about her at this point, her name Jeannie, my first commenter on my blog piece, and talked about how incited she was about a conversation that's insightful and decent and respectful, and she puts exclamation points after that. She said she's been following conversations on being, and if anyone doesn't listen to On Being, oh my heavens, listen to On Being. It's just a wonderful show with a theologian, Eugene Peterson, and a philosopher. And talking about language and the damage that comes to thoughtful discourse and critical thinking when you try to cram it into 140 characters. Donald Trump, are you listening? And or reflected in today's political realm, which can be so divisive. So she said she looks forward to the insight. Well, her mention of Eugene Peterson, boom, I was going and looking at some of Peterson's writing and things, you know, because he's a wonderful author and theologian.
Yes.
And found this video of Bono, who sings Psalms-related music. You know, he's a spiritualist. And Peterson at Flathead Lake out in Montana with a conversation and how their relationship started over the Psalms. And you know, because I think Peterson's in his 80s now. And the video of them looking at the Psalms, talking about the Psalms together by Flathead Lake at Peterson's kitchen table is just wonderful.
So what do you hope that this blog, on the other hand, can be? Civil discourse, conversation starting, community, what else? What do you hope for it?
Well, I love the title that we came up with help from the folks down there, On the Other Hand, because on the other hand, there is always an on the other hand. And right. I think that gets forgotten today more than maybe it ever has in my lifetime, my adult lifetime, in that we often don't consider the other side and we don't respect it. And that's what I hope for this blog, just as I worked and Bill worked and Denise worked on our Mount Blogmore blog, to try and have an exchange that didn't devolve into hate and you know, pejoratives and invectives. And the coarsification of the language that we see in social media, and frankly, sometimes in the mainstream media, that is to me so counterproductive to building a community and to building a conversation.
Is this something that you think has a unique potential in South Dakota because of who we are as a community?
I hope so. I've lived here my whole life. I've never lived anywhere else, so it's hard for me to compare. But most people here that I know, most people, not all, will listen. Most people, if given an opportunity to be respectful, will be respectful. I think that there's a on AM radio, on a lot of the media, there's so much yelling and so much dismissiveness and so much of a degenerated conversation that the inclination is to go the other way. And as I said in my blog, on the other hand, we can go this way. And that's what I want to do, and have conversations like I did with Jeannie. And that doesn't mean it's always about the Psalms and Bono and Eugene Peterson. It can be about very potentially divisive issues of politics, which we're facing now. And yet we're going to try to have conversations that get into those and shape a conversation that means something, that doesn't just, you know, fall into hateful and invective.
If anyone can take us there, it's you, Kevin Wooster. I'm so honored that you're part of the team. I look forward to talking to you every week on this program. And every week you can find and engage and talk with Kevin Wooster online. Go to our website, sdpb.org/Wooster. That's 1-0 Wooster. Kevin Wooster, it's called On the Other Hand. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll see you next week.
Thank you so much, Lori.
After the break, the lessons and legacy of spirituals. You're in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Arthur C. Jones is a teaching professor of music, culture, and psychology with the Department of Musicology, Ethnomusicology, and Theory. He's with the Lamont School of Music at the University of Denver, but he will be in Vermilion on Tuesday, January 17th, 7 p.m. at Farber Hall. He'll be giving a keynote address on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Dr. Arthur Jones founded the Spirituals Project. It's a nonprofit organization with the mission of preserving and revitalizing the music and social justice teachings of the spirituals. He joins us now from Denver, Colorado. Arthur Jones, welcome to In the Moment.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm curious of when you first started sort of seeing this, seeing a spiritual, a slave spiritual, as a topic of serious research and study. How long ago was that for you?
Well, it started back in the early 1990s. I was actually teaching psychology here at the University of Denver. I was in the psychology department, and I'm trained as a clinical psychologist, and I had started immersing myself in music. Music was something that had been really dear to my heart when I was in high school and college, but I had sort of given it up to pursue my career as a psychologist. But when I started singing again, I found my way back to these old songs that, you know, we had sung in church when I was a child and so forth. And initially it was just really the enjoyment of singing these songs that I was familiar with. But then as I started really to think about what the songs were, I realized that I should be spending more time with understanding the history of the songs and kind of how they have evolved over time and what functions they've served. And before I knew it, I was really hooked.
Was there a great deal of research already existing that you sort of stumbled upon, or did you have to create some of your own research? I know you've written a book called...
That's a really great question. There was a lot of stuff that was out there, but it was very scattered, and it wasn't particularly integrated. People had all these questions about, you know, we've heard that the songs were used for secret communication on the Underground Railroad, and we've heard that the freedom songs in the Civil Rights Movement were based on spirituals, you know, things like that. And you could find all this stuff if you really looked for it. And part of what I wanted to do in the book that I wrote was to synthesize all that information into one place. And I also set an impossible task for myself, which I think I sort of at least partially accomplished, which was I wanted it to be a book that would be readable for lay readers, but I also wanted scholars to be able to find something of interest in it as well. So what I did was I created a narrative that was accessible to anyone who's interested, and then I put all the scholarly asides in the footnotes, so if scholars wanted to do that.
And the book is called Wade in the Water, The Wisdom of Spirituals. So take me back to sort of the early origins. How far back does a spiritual go?
Well, it definitely goes back into slavery. How far back is really not known, and the reason is because American scholars, white American scholars, didn't really start studying these songs seriously until the Civil War period, when some of the Union soldiers heard the blacks who were volunteering to serve in the army, they heard them singing these songs, and then they decided that they wanted to record them or notate them and make a record of them. You know, before that, these were songs that were sung in the slave community, and it was for use by people who were enslaved, and nobody outside that community thought that this was serious music or anything that needed to be recorded, and the slave culture was an oral culture, so it's really hard to know. We do know that at least by the early 1900, these songs were pretty prevalent, but before that, we're not sure. My own opinion is that it probably goes back to the 17th century, at least.
How different are those early spirituals from the other music of their time?
Well, they're very different. Initially, what we had really was people who were bringing their African cultural sensibilities to their singing. And so the music resembles a lot of what you would have heard in West Africa. Over time, there were more and more European elements that got integrated into the music, especially when the slave trade became primarily a trade, became primarily an instance of slaveholders wanting to breed their slaves as opposed to importing additional people from West Africa. And so the more people were sort of intergenerational beings of these slave plantations, the more and more European elements got introduced. And then after slavery, there was a concert tradition that got started that became more and more Europeanized, so to speak, but still had a lot of the rhythmic and sort of soulful elements of the original music.
So what does a spiritual do for the people who are singing it during the time of slavery? What does it do for enslaved humans?
Yeah, boy, you asked really wonderful questions, and this is a great one, too. There were multiple functions, and probably the most important function was the function of dealing with trauma and overcoming the psychological trauma that people experienced, that they could voice their feelings in their singing, and in the process of voicing those feelings, they could start a cycle of healing. So that was like really one of the most important functions. Another one was simply creating community solidarity. So the enslaved people would gather together in secret at the end of the day in the bush groves that surrounded these plantations, and they would sing their songs and create new songs there, and those songs would bond them together as a community so that they could sort of feel like they had some mutual support in getting through all the stuff they had to do. And then another function was protest and resistance. The songs often had encoded messages that let people know that it was time for the Underground Railroad to be accessed by people who were wanting to escape, or it would announce the time that there was going to be an insurrection or rebellion. So he had all these different functions that the songs served.
Can you give me an example of a song that maybe I might know from hearing choirs sing that might have had a message that communicated more than what's on its surface?
So Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, do you know that song?
I sure do.
Okay. So that's probably the most well-known spiritual of all the spirituals, and the lyrics are, "Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home," right? And the chariot in all of these slave songs, later on you also had, sometimes you'd hear songs that had train in them.
Right.
They all really were basically, it sort of had double meaning. One was that slaves often felt so bereft and so beat up that they were just waiting to die. And so the chariot is just kind of a symbol of a heavenly vehicle that will take them to heaven. But the other meaning was that it was a symbol of the Underground Railroad. So when people would sing this song, it would be a signal that the time to escape was coming, that people should be vigilant and listen out for information about how they might escape on the Underground Railroad.
Hmm. Do the slaveholders then have a sense that this music has relevance beyond what they're initially seeing? Do they get it? Do they try to oppress the music as well?
Yes and no. You know, that's a really interesting kind of dynamic that comes out of this, is that they knew, I mean, what they knew often was that when they heard a lot of singing, there sometimes came a time when, very shortly after that, people would have escaped or there would be a rebellion or whatever. So they knew that, in general terms, singing was rebellious. But the interesting thing is that there's no record of them ever figuring out the secret message of specific lyrics. And one of the things that some scholars have said about that is that partly is that they so underestimated the intelligence of the people that they were holding in slavery. They didn't really think of them as creative, intelligent people, so it never crossed their mind that they could make up something as complicated as an encoded message in a song.
Hmm.
So Harriet Tubman, you know, who is known as one of the most important leaders of the Underground Railroad, tells the story in her memoir of when she was leaving her plantation, actually walking away, escaping from the plantation, and walking past the master's house, singing a song, you know, goodbye, I'm going to leave you, you know, and the master is like, oh, there goes old Harriet again, talking about going to heaven, had no clue, did not get alarmed. So she was simply able to just walk away.
And that is why Harriet Tubman is Harriet Tubman.
Exactly.
that takes a courage. Oh,
And
a wisdom and an intellect and an
Absolutely.
Understanding that is beyond. Let's jump ahead to the civil rights movement in America in 1960s.
Yeah.
These songs are expanded upon by civil rights leaders, folk musicians. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that era.
Well, one of the things that happened in the civil rights movement is that a lot of the folks who were organizers of the movement recognized that singing was really important, that singing in African-American communities had always been an essential part of what people did. And especially since the movement, a lot of the organizing and the meetings were held in churches, and African-American churches, especially in the rural areas, had this long tradition of communal singing. And they knew that when people were feeling threatened and frightened about what might happen as a result of their participation, that they needed to be able to sing. And the easiest thing they could do was to pull out some of these old songs that had been in the air for ages and repurpose them as freedom songs. And sometimes they would change the lyrics, and sometimes they would just take the original song. So like one of the more popular freedom songs of the movement was "Woke Up This Morning With My Mind Stayed on Freedom."
Mm-hmm.
Well, the original spiritual was "Woke Up This Morning With My Mind Stayed on Jesus." So they just changed changed the Jesus to freedom and became a freedom song. So, you know, that's a good example. Another song that actually didn't get changed in terms of lyrics was "Oh Freedom." You know, "Oh freedom over me, before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free."
Mm.
They just took that song and they said, you know, segregation is much like slavery. We don't need to change those words. We'll just use the song whole, you know. Mm. So "We Shall Overcome" is basically an appropriation of an old spiritual, which was "I Will Overcome Someday," that had been sung, and then some of the movement leaders just changed it to "We." That one was an interesting one because in traditional African-American songs, you never see the word "we." you see I. Really? I shall overcome this little light of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was sort of tacitly understood in the black community that if everybody sings I, everybody's making a commitment to the group. And you don't sing. If you sing we, you never know who's there and who isn't. Everybody's singing we, but it doesn't, well, is John going to be there? Is Eliza going to be there?
Hmm.
But if you sing I, everybody sings I, so that means everybody is committed and they are automatically a group. But when the civil rights movement became an interracial movement and there were people from outside the black community who were involved, the song leaders thought that they better use we so people would know that it means the group.
Hmm.
Which is really interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
So we have just a couple minutes left. I could really talk to you for an hour, but I'm wondering if very quickly we could talk about the choir.
Uh-huh.
and specifically just how singing these songs today can uh-huh. can uh-huh. sort of change, you know, the person who's doing the singing as well as
Absolutely.
The audience.
Yeah. Well, one of the remarkable things about the choir that has been part of the Spirituals Project is that we have lots of people who join the choir, not just because they want to be in a choir, but because they're going through difficult things in their life, or they really are in need of a strong community. And one of the tensions that we've had in the choir, which is kind of interesting, is that we have people who want to be in the choir who really can't sing, but they want to be part of they want to be part of the choir. So our choir directors over the years have kind of looked the other way in auditions when they have someone who they know really needs to be in this community, but they can't sing, and they figure out ways to put them in and allow them to be part of the community and sort of subtly encourage them to just lip sync when it's important for them to do that. And in a really respectful way, you know,
right.
That's, so.
Because it's transformative for everyone, not just people who have a great instrument.
It is transformative.
Yeah.
There's a lot of solidarity in the choir. You know, most choirs, people develop a sense of community, but this goes beyond, and we also do some education for choir members about the history and meanings of the songs and so they know what it is that they're doing, and they know that they're tapping into a deep tradition. And it is also consciously open to anyone who wants to sing. You don't have to be black. So it's consciously interracial, intergenerational.
Arthur Jones is founder of the Spirituals Project. We're going to have to let him go, but you can find his book, Wade in the Water, The Wisdom of Spirituals, online, that has a companion CD, and you can see him in person, hear his keynote speech in Vermilion. That's Tuesday, January 17th, 7 p.m. at USD Farber Hall, Martin Luther King Day, in honor of that. Arthur C. Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you.